Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, for God's glory and that of his kingdom. And to talk about some of the most important parts of this battle space we're in at the moment with respect, well, to the kingdom, among other things, I'm very pleased to have with us David Wormser. Dr. Wormser is an extraordinarily accomplished public servant, a naval intelligence officer, also a civilian advisor to Vice President of the United States, the National Security Advisor, Undersecretaries of State, and the like. He has brought all of that expertise to bear with us at the Center for Security Policy, where he is now our Senior Director for Middle East-related programs. We're always delighted to have him on the program. Here at Securing America, David Wormser, welcome back.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here, Frank.
Well, wonderful, except the things we have to talk about are not so wonderful, I'm afraid, at the moment. But let's get into it, David, with respect to what is happening on the ground in the Holy Land at the moment. The state of Israel seems to be seeing once again an uptick in the Palestinian terrorist violence that has been an affliction off and on over the years, intifadas of the past. Are we at the beginning, do you think, of a new intifada? And if so, why?
Yeah, we definitely are. I mean, the volume speaks a lot. 11 Israelis killed in 4 days, three separate terrorist attacks. There have been several other attempts. And we had over the last week or two a lot of incitement coming from the Palestinian Authority, coming from Hamas, coming from various Palestinian organizations. And as a result, there's definitely, even before the attacks, there was a climate and expectation of escalation, again on Jerusalem, just like last year. And this terrorist wave, which is the worst Israel's faced in 20-some years, is very clearly the beginning of something much larger, unfortunately.
David, when you talk about incitement, that's a perennial problem with the Palestinian Authority, is it not? To say nothing of Hamas, but even the guys who are supposedly Israel's partners for peace, at least according to the Biden team, are endlessly promoting jihad against Israel and lionizing those who perpetrate it, are they not? And talk a little bit about the aftermath of, I think, this most recent terrorist attack on the streets of a town in the West Bank where the terrorist came from.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the incitement and so forth. The Palestinian Authority, the PLO, let's remember, the Palestinian Authority is only a structure for the PLO, Yasser Arafat's organization that we also know well. It's only a structure for them to exist in the West Bank and Gaza. And they've never stopped being at war. They've never recognized Israel formally. They've never really reconciled with the legitimacy of Israel. They've never concluded a true peace with Israel. And instead, they've been preparing their populations over and over again, constantly, for war. The Palestinians of the West Bank, or I'd prefer to call it Judea and Samaria, they are more radical now, more instigated into violence and educated into violence from a young age now than they have been on any generation before. And this is an indictment of the Palestinian Authority, and it's worse. It's an indictment of the Europeans and Americans who fund these structures of education and incitement in those territories. As far as this terrorist attack, you see the results of it, not only in the terrorist attack itself, but across West Bank cities, whether it's Jenin or whether it's the various refugee camps, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in Ramallah, It's celebratory. There are hundreds and thousands of people taking to the streets, shooting off firecrackers, handing out sweets to little children handing out sweets to everybody to celebrate the murder of these five Israelis. So there's a climate of war, climate of hatred of Jews, climate of anger that is carefully cultivated and weaponized and encouraged by the Palestinian Authority, which is ostensibly the partner for peace.
Yeah. David, on that score, the prospect that there might actually be at some point some opportunity for the Palestinians to vote on a new government, given what you've just said, suggests that it would almost certainly be even more aligned with the jihadists, Hamas, notably among them, were that to happen. To what extent is this, incitement to violence and indoctrination of the Palestinian people with the idea that only by liberating their, you know, land, as they call it, from the Jordan to the sea, is there going to be an acceptable outcome? Is this being further intensified, would you say, by the perception that the U.S. government is now no longer closely aligned, as it was certainly under Donald Trump, with the Israelis? That, in other words, there's daylight through which these guys can run and operate and wage war, as you say, against Israel.
There's a lot of daylight right now, and it is motivating a lot of the violence. I mean, whether it's in the UN Human Rights Commission, which today, despite everything going on in Ukraine, and despite the terrorist attacks over the last week, will put forward and pass, I'm sure, four anti-Israeli resolutions that don't mention terrorism or anything today. And it will appoint a new rapporteur for the Palestinian affairs issue, who's basically said Israel is a Nazi country and should be treated like the Nazis were treated. So again, there's we've returned to this body. We left this body half a decade ago, and this administration returned to it. And this was seen as an act that was hostile to Israel. The abandonment of the Israeli concerns, the complete ignoring of Israeli concerns, and frankly, Saudi, UAE, and Bahraini concerns about Iran and the terrorist designation of the IRGC, who's killed hundreds and probably thousands of Americans, let alone Jews and Israelis and other Arabs. Again, this is daylight. The statements by Secretary Blinken upon arriving in Israel, which focused on settler violence and the danger of settler violence, in this, our ambassador to Israel, Nidus, focusing on Israel shouldn't do stupid things like settlements and settler violence. The truth is, settler violence is very rare. It does occur. It's a problem. It shouldn't occur. But it's rare, and it hasn't killed any Palestinians at all. And it's not lethal at this point. That compared to the absolute massive volume of daily attacks on Jewish targets. And we hear about terrorist attacks that are lethal. We don't hear about the daily attacks where cars are driving on the highways and Molotov cocktails are thrown on them, rocks. We're talking about not pebbles. We're talking about rocks the size of your fist or larger being thrown at passing cars going 60 miles an hour, and so on and so forth. The amount of violence that Israeli settlers and Israelis traveling on Israeli roads going through Arab areas right now face is unbelievable. And then finally, the immense amount of violence inside the Arab communities against each other. None of this is what America's mentioning. And the perception in the Palestinian area is, that's it. The United States is done with America. Now it's time to go after the Jews. That's essentially the mentality.
David, this brings me to the Negev summits that took place last week. Talk a little bit about the extent to which what was, I think, very hopefully a furthering of the relationship between Israel and a number of Arab states, on the one hand, was sabotaged by inclusion of the United States Secretary of State in the course of part of the summit. And again, to what extent does that feed into the larger problem that we're facing? Actually, I'm going to ask you to hold those thoughts, come back to us in just a moment with more with David Wormser right after this. Sorry, I lost track of the time there. I don't know how far over I went, Tim, but let me just do a quick wrap on that. Let me just do the last 30 seconds or so. Dr. Wormser, we ask, do you hold a second with this? Sorry, 3, 2, 1. Dr. Wormser, we have to take a short break. I want to come back with you to this point about the extent to which American involvement or engagement, such as it is contributing to the problem. We'll talk about that and much more with Dr. David Wormser on the other side of this break.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we are joined by Dr. David Wormser once more to talk about what happened when Israel convened some summit meetings last week with Arab interlocutors under the rubric of the Abraham Accords, a very promising development under the Trump administration, but brought into the mix the proverbial skunk at the picnic, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. David, talk us through what happened in the course of those meetings and the net effect, do you think?
Well, very quickly, the Abraham Accords represents an inversion of what American traditional foreign policy was, which is that the United States traditionally had asked its allies around the world to restrain themselves and to forego a lot of their own strategic initiative and interests, in return for which we would assume for them their defense. And this became a burden for us and an irritation for our allies. The Trump administration inverted that and basically said, you in the region, work together and pick up the ball, carry the water for your own defense. But on the other hand, America will have your back. We won't restrain you. We won't constantly harp on you for you pursuing your interests. And the result of it was the Abraham Accords. And what this summit was a working summit, was intended to be at least, was a working summit by the regional allies to craft the common strategy to deal with two major issues coming down the pike. One is Iran and the American position on Iran, which is, frankly, a surrender to the Iranian demands. And on the other side, the food crisis that is about to emerge in the region because they so heavily depend on food from Ukraine, and the ships are no longer coming. So especially a country like Egypt is in really dire straits right now. So the two, and that could cause major political unrest. So the summit was a working summit to deal with those two issues. By bringing in the United States, it changed the nature of the summit. It became another peace festival that focused on the Palestinian issue because the United States forced the Palestinian issue in. And this, unfortunately, I think was partly intentionally done by the United States to force itself in because it wanted to return the relationship to what it was, whereas the Israelis and the Arabs are restrained, supplicant, and in exchange for which we assume responsibility for their security. But of course, we're negotiating with their chief enemy on their nuclear program and surrendering a lot of very dangerous concessions. So it was a non-starter and it just failed in that sense. and really only sabotaged and tarnished a bit the other half of the summit, which was truly an expression of regional cooperation to deal with what sadly for me is a post-American era for the moment.
Well, and it remains to be seen who will fill that void. But turning to Iran, David Wormser, when you look at the policy approach that's been taken by the administration since it came to office, but what seems to be ratcheting up dramatically now in the end game of these negotiations, facilitated by, of all people, the Russians, we're looking at what would seem to me to be an even more frightening prospect, both for Israel and for those Arab nations in the Gulf, who would, I think, be far less inclined to rely on the United States for their security than they have of late.
Well, I think the 1-2 punch of the current policy on Iran, the dangerous 1-2 punch, is on one side, the restrictions on Iran are going to be weaker, watered down, and the timelines are not really going to be extended on anything. So the Iranians are getting awfully close to legally, under such an agreement, pursue a full-tilt nuclear program that allows for breakout to happen within weeks. On the other hand, the lifting, the demand, and I'm sure we've conceded this by the language that Blinken used in the summit, the lifting of various sanctions and terrorist designations means that the Iranian government will be awash in currency and money to pay for all this. So all these attacks on Abu Dhabi and the Saudis, terrorism from Hamas and missiles on Israel, as well as the sophistication of Hezbollah, will take a generational leap forward, being infused with hundreds of billions of dollars that will be released for Iran through lifting of oil sanctions. Right off the bat, we will probably release about $20 billion in sanctions directly to the Iranians. So one can only imagine, this is a regime that was down to about $4 billion in reserve currency only a year ago. So this 1-2 punch guarantees that Iran is on a rampage in the region, feels a tailwind pushing it forward. And the United States, which is the champion of all these various allies across the region, is actually siding with their enemy, causing a greater humiliation and weakening of their position.
Yeah. David, is there any basis, as far as you can tell, and we're still waiting to see the final details of this agreement, but some of the things that you've mentioned have been leaking out, including, again, this enormous windfall in terms of further cash to this terrorist sponsoring regime. But is there going to be any basis, as far as you can tell, for the claims of this administration that they've actually stopped or even measurably slowed the Iranian pell-mell rush to getting nuclear capabilities?
Well, one of the key concessions in the 2015 agreement was that Iran would give up its nuclear, its uranium, enriched uranium stockpile, in exchange for which it would be free to work on next-generation centrifuges and replace them. Well, of course, the real danger here with that is that if Iran has old, slow centrifuges, it can cross the threshold to a bomb, but then it would take half a year for it to build another bomb. So between reaching a red line and breakout for Iran is months, if not years. Once they install the new centrifuges that have multiple times as the capacity of producing uranium in high enrichment and is perfected through testing, they can break out in a week or two once they start full tilt production and go from one bomb to the next within a week or two. So they were willing then to give up their stockpile in order to reach that capacity, because they know that the most dangerous moment will be from the moment they're reaching, getting close to breakout and after breakout. And that's too prolonged. So they had to have these more modern centrifuges, and that's what they got. Now, we're not even asking them to remove the uranium stockpile from Iran itself. They can keep the stockpile. They just have to put it under Russian control in Iran. So as if that really controls it and means it's not accessible. Iranians themselves say they want that because they want to have access to it if America, quote, cheats, whatever that definition.
And the Russians would presumably, especially under these circumstances, be more than accommodating to their allies. So, David, just to wrap this up, as things stand now, it seems as though the government of Israel must feel as though it has no choice but to take action to defend itself against this incipient nuclear capability. Is that how you see it?
Yes, I think the Israelis are the last to realize that in the region that they're on their own, and that if it's not for their action, there will be a nuclear Iran with all that entails. So I think the Israelis are coming to terms with that realization, being such a close ally and having invested so much in their friendship with us. That's a terrifying realization. Their Arab partners, ironically, are the ones who are in trying to convince them of this more quickly. But yes, I believe the Israelis are there. The good news is they have a number of Arab states now on their side. The bad news is that they're facing Russia on their northern border. And this administration, again, has shown very little willingness to support allies in meaningful ways and rapidly effective ways, even against Russia and Europe.
Well, and it may actually get to the point where they're interposing objections to and interfering with whatever the Israelis may feel they need to do, as presumably will the Russians. A very fraught situation, needless to say. David Wormser, your expertise on these matters and your insights into them is really appreciated. I hope you come back to us next week with more. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Jay Richards about the transgender issue in Florida and elsewhere and what it means for you right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm delighted to say we are joined by Dr. Jay Richards. He is a very, very courageous and, I think, clear-eyed advocate for, well, traditional values, among other things, at the Heritage Foundation, where he has been leading efforts to raise awareness about a topic that is controversial, to be sure, but I think central to the question of the nuclear family, among other things. And that is the challenges to it posed by people who believe that all kinds of sexual preferences and identities and relationships can be substituted, really, for these traditional norms and values. And we're delighted to have him with us to talk, among other things, about what's emerged in the course of the Senate's questioning of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, specifically with respect to the leniency that she has exhibited over some time now with respect to child sexual predators. And it's great to have you, Jay, with us to just sort of take stock on what we should learn from what Ketanji Brown Jackson has been saying and doing in this space, including in response to questions from the United States Senate.
Absolutely, Frank. Great to be with you. I mean, what emerged in the hearings with Judge Jackson is something that's disturbing. And a lot of people, if you followed social media, said, well, they're playing gotcha. But the reality is that her views clearly seem to be shaped by a growing movement, certainly in legal circles, which is to essentially to soft sell what we would call pedophilia or sex with minors. And so, of course, basically what she exhibited is a great deal of leniency for people who are caught with large amounts of child porn on their computer. And her argument is that, well, there should be a difference between people that produce heinous child porn and people that actually consume it. And of course, we have differences already in the laws and in sentencing on those. So it's not as if people don't recognize the difference. But the consumption of child porn is still a very egregious crime for the obvious reason that it requires child sexual abuse in order to produce it. And so they're essentially contributing to that. Now, legally, people say, well, there are a lot of people that consume child porn that aren't actually going to be predators. They're not going to act on that. It's, of course, there's no argument that every person consuming child porn is not also directly a predator, but it certainly feeds into that. And so the idea that we'd be squishy on this is mind-boggling to lots of normal people. And what's, to me, much more troubling is that this is part of a larger movement, I would say, to regularize or normalize, at least reducing drastically the age of consent for sexual activity.
This is being manifested, among other things, by, as the left is wont to do, as you know, Jay, coming up with a brand under which this practice of child rape, child sexual abuse of other kinds, and predatory behavior that leads to that is described simply as minor attracted persons. Where does that lead if this in fact becomes, as you say, regularized?
Well, effectively, what you can see happening over certainly the last 20 years in our public life, and longer than that, if you read the academic journals and the law review articles, is a changing of what we would have traditionally thought of as various behaviors. So people might have proclivities to do something. Some people have a proclivity to be alcoholic or to lash out and be violent, and to transform those into identities in which it sort of describes who you are. So we did this certainly with sex, so that rather than just referring to people, we talk about heterosexuals and homosexuals. Notice that's a movement from preferences or orientations to an identity. And the same exact thing, disturbingly, is happening with, as you said, minor attracted persons. So these would be people that are attracted to not just young teenagers, which is, of course, the kind of sexual attraction to older teenagers is a perennial problem. But when we're talking about sexual attraction to young kids, that is, properly speaking, pedophilia. It's deeply disturbing. And so this idea that we would just sort of basically redefine this as an orientation or a kind of self-identity is disastrous, especially when you realize that perennial biological categories such as male and female have also now, they've been reduced to identity. So essentially, perversions and preferences such as pedophilia are raised to an identity, and male and female biology is reduced to identity. So it's all just self-identification.
Yeah, which again, we saw manifested in Ketanji Brown Jackson's testimony about not being able to identify what a woman is. This is really, again, problematic. Jay, is it a stretch to say that this seems to fit into, well, a larger Marxist agenda? The Black Lives Matter organization founders, among the others, have very explicitly said they're interested in breaking up the nuclear family. Is that sort of the undercurrent against which this is being produced?
It is, and it's a complicated intellectual genealogy. I would say if you're going to trace these ideas with identity, especially queer theory and gender ideology, it starts as a type of neo-Marxism, that is the cultural Marxism, which is itself a split off from Orthodox Marxism. And then it's refracted through both French postmodernism and the Frankfurt School, which we now call critical theory. But of course, as you said, the Black Lives Matter movement explicitly identified as Marxist. And in particular, I think here's the key point, is that they identified their cause with demolishing the nuclear family. And that's what's important to realize about these movements. Don't expect this to be a tight, coherent philosophical worldview. What we're dealing with is a cultural wrecking ball. And just like Lenin, just like Marx himself, they recognize the family as the primary bulwark against an all-consuming and all-powerful state and ideology. And so it's perfectly consistent that they would do that. But in some ways, any stick will do to destroy this. And so, you know, the colors under which it trades will vary. But the attack on the nuclear family and on, essentially on civilization, that is the perennial thing that you have to keep in mind.
Yeah, a civilized society comes undone as these sorts of criminal behaviors are normalized and rationalized. Jay, an effort to push back on some of the elements of this, if you will, not terribly coherent but destructive program, was just enacted and signed into law in Florida by Governor DeSantis. It has been, mischaracterized, defamed, I would say, as the Don't Say Gay bill. Talk a little bit about the bill, what's actually in it, and why that's not the case, but more to the point, why it is needed.
Well, it's directly related to what we're talking about. By the way, the name of the bill is the Parental Rights in Education Bill. Even the Associated Press couldn't manage to choke that out yesterday when Governor DeSantis signed it. It's what you would expect based on the name. So it's basically a guarantee of transparency in public schools for not just curriculum, but teacher training programs and anything that might find its way into the classroom so that parents have to sign off on that. Also, so parents have to sign on to psychological and medical interventions, which are actually happening under the banner of gender ideology, in which schools will socially transition, say, a girl, in one case in Florida, who, unbeknownst to her parents, the school where the daughter was actually changed her name to a male name and treated her as if she was a male. The parents are now suing. That stuff's actually happening, even in conservative states like Florida. And then the thing that's gotten all the media attention is effectively a paragraph which says in grades K through third grade, teachers will not introduce topics having to do with sexual orientation and gender identity. It didn't say particular sexual orientation. It just says we're not going to have teachers leading discussions about this with 5 and 6 and 7 year old kids. And so if you think this move to sexualize children or to reduce the age of consent is just conspiracy theories, look at the actual response to the bill in Florida. This is something that 90% of the population would probably support. Governor DeSantis had to deal with the full onslaught of the teachers' unions, the Democratic Party, even the Disney Corporation. He said, too bad, I'm going to sign it. He did exactly what he should do, and I would expect more of the same to follow his leadership, I hope, in other states in the country.
You mentioned a particularly striking aspect of this. The Disney Corporation actually, of course, was founded by Walt Disney, a man who both personally was committed to and I think contributed mightily to, you know, sort of lifting up the family through his various entertainment ventures. What is it that is causing the company that bears his name to be taking a prominent role in, well, mau-mauing the governor to, veto this legislation and otherwise embrace such problematic behavior?
Well, it's the distance that this ideology has already traveled in our institutions. I mean, most Americans were too busy to focus on this stuff. And we think, well, maybe this is happening in, you know, left-wing colleges or something like that. No, this is happening in every major corporation in the country, whether it's on the board of the corporation, whether it's through HR. I think that the president of Disney, the CEO, he's actually terrified by his woke employees more than anything, which is sort of mind-boggling, but that CEOs of large corporations would essentially be dragged around by young 20-something employees. But that's what's happening. And so the reality is that the ideologues on this gender theory are just so vocal and so intense that a lot of people, heads of corporations, even if they don't necessarily agree with it, are terrified by it. And I think until the other side wakes up and realizes, look, they need to be more afraid of parents and school boards than they're afraid of their IT department at 20-somethings in their offices, I think we're going to continue to have this. It's just, I'm thankful for governors like Ron DeSantis who have the spine to stand up to it. Because at the moment, I mean, look, I think DeSantis probably has the real support of 90% of the public, but they don't know what's happening. And so that's the message.
This is where leadership comes in. Dr. Jay Richards, very quickly, how can people find out more about your work at the Heritage Foundation?
Just check me out. We write on this and we're covering this topic constantly at heritage.org.
Terrific. We follow you closely and look forward to having you back soon. We'll be right back with much more here at Securing America. Stay tuned.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And I'm pleased to say we're joined by Bill Marshall. He is a longtime intelligence analyst and investigator for both the government of the United States and various private sector entities. These days, he's the senior investigator for an outstanding operation, Judicial Watch. We're always glad to catch up with him. Bill, welcome back to Securing America.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be back with you.
You've been doing some really important work on behalf of Judicial Watch, looking into the facts concerning these vaccinations for COVID-19. We have been buffeted by lots of information, much of it conflicting about their safety, their lack of safety, adverse events, the degree to which really extraordinary risks are being taken by this effort to compel people to accept these vaccinations and now boosters. Give us a quick overview as to what you have found in your investigation to date.
Right. Well, I was honestly very concerned about these vaccines from the very start, and I use that term advisedly because they are not vaccines as vaccines are traditionally understood. And you've had terrific guests on there from including some of our mutual medical and scientific friends. It's a gene therapy technology it's an entirely new technology. And as you know, vaccines typically go through a 7 to 10 year testing period before they're rolled out. Now, as far as we know, these so-called vaccines were only trialed for a couple of months before, you know, they were approved under emergency, or they're not approved, they were authorized under emergency use authorization, which means that the manufacturers, of course, have virtually complete legal immunity from any harms that may be caused by them. That means deaths and injuries. And as of about 2 weeks ago, I haven't got the up-to-date figure, but as of, I think, March 14th, there were over 26,000 deaths reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is a CDC, a government database, following administration of these so-called COVID vaccines. Now, that's more than double all the deaths of all other vaccines combined for the prior 30 years. So in a little over a year from a single so-called vaccine, we have more than double all other vaccines over a period of 30 years. Okay.
Now, a couple of questions. When you say a single vaccine, do you mean the several versions of the vaccine by Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J? And to the extent, Bill, that there is evidence that the reporting, the voluntary reporting under this so-called VAERS system greatly understates the actual magnitude of the adverse events, it would seem that there's considerably more deaths and a lot of other harm done besides. Is that your assessment?
That's exactly right. It's called the underreporting factor. That means that they estimate, you know, the experts, and I'm talking about guys like Robert Malone, okay, the guy who invented, who holds, I believe, 9 of the patents for the mRNA vaccine technology, says conservatively, the underreporting factor is 5. It could be anywhere from 5 to maybe 41, some of the estimates. In other words, you have to multiply the stated number in VAERS by somewhere between 5 and 41 to get the real number of deaths and injuries. And I would add that VAERS indicates that over 48,000 people are permanently disabled now from these so-called COVID vaccines. All right. So then again, you multiply that by whatever the true underreporting factor is, and it's astonishing. Now, I will say that, and you've had terrific guests on, like Edward, our mutual friend Edward Dowd, former Wall Street investment banker and data analyst, who's talking about who's brought up the issue of the Defense Medical Epidemiology Database. This is the Defense Department database of medical of maladies that afflict service personnel, and it is also showing shocking increase in ailments that are afflicting servicemen following the rollout of these vaccines. The rise has been just striking, on the order of 500% for cardiac issues, tenfold increase in neurological problems.
Now, Bill, let me ask you about that, because, of course, subsequent to several whistleblowers bringing that information forward, the U.S. government has gone back and said, oh, no, actually, there's not been this huge spike because the baseline was understated. We had a lot more illness in the system than was properly reported, and therefore it's pretty much flatline. What's your sense of all of that?
Okay, color me skeptical. Okay, that would be an understatement. Okay, so they just discovered this so-called glitch in this massive database when it's exposed by Senator Ron Johnson at his hearing. The whistleblowers' information is brought forth. These are two active duty lieutenant colonel surgeons and a retired colonel, who have all come forward with this information. And I know one of them personally. These are great people who've put their careers on the line, who have said what we suddenly learned just when we reveal this information, that there has been this so-called glitch for the prior 5 years reporting. It's just, I'm sorry, it's then that demonstrates either, there's one of two possibilities: gross incompetence in the military medical establishment, which I don't believe, or gross fraud. And I will say, I am going after those records as well. I've requested all directives sent to those individuals who maintain the DMED, this Defense Department database. I've asked for all directives that they've received regarding changes to the data. I've asked for the internal communications of those individuals who maintain that database regarding the data, as well as the Secretary of Defense and other senior officials in the military, their communications about that database.
This is a prime example of what you and your colleagues at Judicial Watch do so well, Bill, which is use the Freedom of Information Act vehicles to try to extract information about these, indicators of what actually was going on here. And I look forward to hearing more about what you find. Hopefully they will respond and you'll get the goods on what went down here, because as you say, it is deeply suspicious and creates a lack of confidence, I'm sure, on the part of military personnel in their own system. And Bill, hold the thought. We're going to come back with more about particularly what you found lately in one of these FOIA efforts with respect to Dr. Anthony Fauci. That and more with Bill Marshall right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are talking with one of the most intrepid and successful investigators into, government shenanigans, among other things. His name is Bill Marshall. He is the senior investigator with a terrific organization, Judicial Watch. And Bill, we were talking before the break about the macro level concerns that you've had about these so-called vaccines and their harm. There's no bigger champion of these vaccines, no one who is arguably more directly responsible for that harm, I would say, than Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's sort of gone to ground of late, but he seems to be back now arguing that, we might need to think about going back into lockdowns and masking ups and all the rest of it. What have you found in your investigations, Bill, through Freedom of Information Act requests, among other things, about Fauci's role in all of this, and in particular in his suppression of therapies like hydroxychloroquine, which might have made a huge difference in the number of people who were ostensibly killed by COVID on the one hand, and perhaps have been exposed unnecessarily to harm from the vaccines?
Well, exactly right. Anthony Fauci, of course, has sort of had been the public face of this COVID response. And as you mentioned, he seems to have gone ground. I question that. We'll see if he reemerges in force when the next wave or something comes along with this virus. But he has been a critical figure, and I have sent numerous FOIA requests to NIH. Well, he's with NIAID, which is the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which is a unit of NIH, seeking his communications, right, National Institutes of Health, right, and seeking his communications regarding the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which his agency was funding. And of course, this is where, in all probability, this virus was created. Now, and of course, I think the Chinese are still arguing that this was a species to species transmission, from bats or whatever. But of course, many highly reputable scientists have said that, all the markers, all the indicators are that this was a lab creation. And of course, Anthony Fauci was, they were funding this insane, what I think as a layman to be, what I think to be insane research, is gain of function research. And this so alarmed the Obama administration. Something happened in 2014 where they actually put a moratorium on government funding of this sort of Frankenstein research that was largely being conducted, by the way, by Ralph Baric, is sort of this genius virologist down at the University of North Carolina, who actually trained the head of the Wuhan lab, Xi Zheng Li. She was, I believe, literally at the North Carolina the UNC campus working with him. And then she, headed up this project, apparently, which then led to the release of this either accidentally or intentionally, the release of this virus.
This is the so-called bat lady, as I recall. Is that right? And she's been specializing in both coronaviruses from bats and evidently was, as you say, trained up not only by Dr. Baric here in the United States, but with U.S. tax dollars, both there and in China. So what we've seen here is, a truly Frankenstein operation, as you say, Bill. But to what extent was Fauci both knowledgeable about that work, complicit in trying to conceal it, and more to the point, directly involved in the effort to suppress alternatives to vaccines, which he had also been working on, as a means of dealing with the effects of COVID?
I think time will tell as we unearth more and more communications, as people come forward regarding his level of knowledge. Although I find it clearly they were, what they did in 2014 was they offshored, once a moratorium was put in by the Obama administration, they sort of offshored the funding of this gain of function research through this so-called nonprofit EcoHealth Alliance based in New York, run by Peter Daszak, who then, funneled the money to the Wuhan lab. But as to the degree of his knowledge, well, we'll find out. Clearly, he was involved in suppressing, you know, the scientists who authored the Great Barrington Declaration. These are eminent epidemiologists, you know, Jay Bhattacharya, for example, at Stanford. I believe it was Martin Kohlorff at Harvard. And there was another, I believe, an Oxford University scientist who said that, you know, very early in this pandemic response, we're saying that, you know, all these methods are kind of crazy. This lockdown strategy, it just does not work. It's not part of historically of pandemic response planning. So then he, you know, famously.
But it was being promoted by the Chinese Communist Party at the time and useful to people who sought to exercise control here in the United States.
Exactly right. I mean, this is what we've seen. The face of fascism has really come to bear itself at all levels of government in our own country, as well as, you know, countries around the world. It's just shocking to the extent that the veneer of democracy is, you know, is so thin, obviously. And this has really brought this forth. But he was, you know, he then.
And Tony Fauci was among those, you know, calling for this kind of behavior. No?
This dictatorial behavior, right. And then he and Francis Collins, the head of NIH and, you know, sort of ostensibly Fauci's boss, then conspired to take down these eminent scientists, you know, calling them fringe scientists and, you know, who authored this Great Barrington Declaration. So clearly this suppression effort was overseen by Collins and Fauci, and, you know, they went to great lengths, of course. And then, as you mentioned, they tried to suppress ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which was known to be a very effective treatment in the first SARS virus back, you know, 18 years ago. It's a zinc ionophore.
And had been shown to have promise in this one as well, I think, as your research and others has demonstrated. Bill, we're out of time for today, but there's a lot more to talk about on all of this. We really appreciate the work you do at Judicial Watch and that of your team. I know you'll keep it up, but I hope you'll come back to us again soon with further updates on all of this. I want to thank all the rest of you for joining us today at this edition of Securing America. I hope you'll look us up at securingamerica.tv for more about what you can do to help in that regard, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.